Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, we continue coverage of our recent trip to Haiti, where the Sojourner Truth team covered the graduation of students from the University of the Aristide Foundation, known as UNIFA. And also, we visited La Saline in Haiti's capital of Port-au-Prince, where the residents say the worst massacre since the brutal Duvalier years took place. The massacres began in November 2018 and are continuing. They are being wrongly reported by mainstream media as resulting from gang warfare, and we are told they occur with the knowledge and support of the U.S.-backed Haitian government of Jovenel Moïse. Our guests are Judith Merkinson, who is the president of the National Lawyers Guild in the Bay Area, and Seth Donnelly, a human rights campaigner and teacher in Palo Alto, California. They were part of a human rights delegation to Haiti. We spoke to them while on the ground in Haiti about their experiences. Also, we celebrate National Poetry Month, which is marked in April annually in the United States and Canada. The Academy of American Poets kicked off the month-long celebration in 1996 in order to create awareness and appreciation of poetry. They took inspiration from Black History Month, which is celebrated in February, and Women's History Month, which is celebrated in March. The push to promote National Poetry Month included the works of Black women poets like Maya Angelou, Alice Walker, and Gwendolyn Brooks. It has proven to be successful. Many educators and librarians in the United States have embraced the initiative, including it in their school curriculum and lesson plans. And according to a 2017 survey of public participation in the arts conducted by the National Endowment of the Arts, the number of poetry readers in the United States has nearly doubled in the past 5 years, from 6.7% of U.S. adults in 2012 to nearly 12% in 2017. That means 28 million people have read a poem during 2017, the highest number since the first survey was first conducted 16 years ago. In honor of National Poetry Month, here on Sojourner Truth, we hear from Ron Baca, a teacher and Chicano-based poet based in El Sereno in East Los Angeles. He grew up in Boyle Heights, also part of East Los Angeles. We discuss his poetry, his inspiration, the interrelationship between art and politics, and you will also hear him read several of his poems reflecting local culture, the political landscape, love, fear, inspiration, and community. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. A San Francisco federal judge has overturned the Trump administration's policy of returning asylum seekers to Mexico as they wait for an immigration court to hear their cases. But Judge Richard Seaborg put his ruling on hold for several days to give the administration the chance to ask for an appeals court review. Judge Seaborg granted a request on behalf of 11 asylum seekers from Central America and legal advocacy groups to halt the practice while their lawsuit moves forward. The judge ruled that the administration's new policy lacks sufficient protections to ensure migrants don't face undue risk to their lives or freedom in Mexico. One of the attorneys who challenged the Trump policy said the legal victory is especially important amid reports that the Trump administration is planning to move toward even more extreme immigration policies. The ruling came a day after Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen resigned, reportedly after losing a power struggle with White House counselor Stephen Miller, who has advocated even more extreme anti-immigrant measures. Nielsen, though, said she still supports Trump's policies.
Share the president's goal of securing the border. I will continue to support all efforts to address the humanitarian and security crisis on the border.
Stephen Miller reportedly is helping to orchestrate a larger campaign to clean house at the Department of Homeland Security. The head of Citizenship and Immigration Services and Homeland Security's General Counsel are expected to be pushed out of their positions. Senate Democratic Minority Leader Chuck Schumer called Nielsen's tenure a cruel chapter, and despite her advocacy for Trump's policies, including separating children from their families, Schumer said she still wasn't radical enough for President Trump.
This is further proof that the president is kowtowing to the worst instincts of people and to the conservative, hard right, and extreme voices in the Republican Party. With no or little regard for our national security or the ability to function efficiently. And what he's done by these constant firings and constant change of policy has simply created chaos at the border. Nobody knows what the policy will be from day to day and week to week and month to month. He doesn't tell the top people in his departments that he's changed his plans.
The House is expected to vote today to restore net neutrality rules overturned by the Federal Communications Commission under the Trump administration. The FCC voted 3-2 in December of 2017 to repeal Obama-era rules barring internet service providers from blocking or slowing internet content or offering so-called paid fast lanes. Democratic Rules Committee Chair Jim McGovern said the vast majority of the U.S. population backs net neutrality, including Republicans.
An overwhelming majority of Americans, 86% in a recent University of Maryland poll, are opposed to what the president's FCC has done. That includes 82% of Republicans. We should continue that bipartisan spirit, this Congress, and finally protect Americans from abusive practices by internet service providers.
The White House is threatening to veto the legislation if it clears the House and Senate. California Congressman Eric Swalwell has joined the crowded race for the 2020 Democratic presidential nomination. Swalwell made the announcement during a taping of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert.
I talked to teachers and truckers and, you know, nurses, and they feel like they're just running in place, and it's not adding up to anything. I talked to people who are just like me, who are the first in their family to go to college. They've got a lot of student debt, can't buy a home, can't start a business. I talked to kids who sit in their classroom afraid that they'll be the next victim of gun violence.
Swalwell said combating gun violence is a top priority. Israel's Elections Committee has banned hidden cameras at polling stations following a Palestinian political party's complaints that it observed Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party deploying staff members who attempted to secretly surveil predominantly Palestinian polling stations. Palestinian political parties lambasted the cameras as a ploy to depress their constituents' turnout. In today's election, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is seeking his fourth consecutive term and fifth overall, including an earlier stint in the 1990s. Former Army Chief of Staff Benny Gantz is in a tough race to replace Netanyahu. Glaciers all over the planet are melting much faster than scientists thought. A new study shows they're losing 369 billion tons of snow and ice each year, more than half of that in North America. The world's glaciers are shrinking five times faster now than they were in the 1960s. The study found their melt is accelerating due to global warming and adding more waters to already rising seas. A study author said in the regions where they're melting the fastest, the glaciers will not survive the century.
Those were our news headlines. Today, we will be continuing our on-the-ground coverage from the recent trip to Haiti by the Sojourner Truth team. You will hear a report back from Haiti with Judith Merkinson, president of the National Lawyers Guild in the Bay Area, and Seth Donnelly, a teacher and human rights campaigner based in Palo Alto. While on the ground, we discuss with them their reflections on the trip. Both of them participated in the human rights delegation to Haiti investigating poverty and state violence in that Caribbean nation. So, Seth, tell us, why is Haiti important to you?
Why have you been
coming here and you keep coming back?
So I got involved in going to Haiti in the summer 2004. I joined the Haiti Action Committee, which is a Bay Area solidarity organization.
Around the time of the coup,
right? So the coup had happened.
The U.S.-backed coup.
Exactly. So the U.S. had violently overthrown President Aristide, and the coup also overthrew thousands of locally elected officials. And so it was a widespread, systematic period of repression. I already had a background of involvement in human rights, social justice work. So as a high school teacher, I had that summer off. And so I went down on a small Haiti Action Committee team to investigate the situation primarily in the prisons, to see, to interview political prisoners. We've been receiving reports of course, widespread killings after the coup, and also massive numbers of political prisoners. And so we spent 3 weeks in the prisons investigating the conditions and meeting political prisoners. And after that trip, I came back the following summer as part of a labor delegation. And that following summer of 2005 was when MINUSTAH forces carried out, that's the UN occupation forces, they carried out a massacre in Cité Soleil on July 6. And so I got in with a small team of human rights workers and Haitian workers, and we were able to document evidence of this massacre. And ever since then, I've kept going back to Haiti, and after the earthquake, been taking students down as well and working on various projects.
You had a human rights background even before you came to Haiti for the first time, and I suppose the skills that you learned in documenting the UN massacres in Cité Soleil, did you imagine that so many years later you will need those skills again on the ground as you did today?
That's a powerful question and comment. And today in La Saline, with you and with our team, it vividly took me back to how I felt being in Cité Soleil 14 years ago after the massacre there, and the level of terrorism, state terrorism being directed against the most vulnerable sectors of the population here, the poorest sectors of the population, against men, women, and children. It was palpable in La Saline. It was palpable in Cité Soleil when there were still bodies on the ground. And today in La Saline, people came out and gave testimony to us, and we were able to find physical evidence as well of the massacre. So the types of investigations we were doing back then were definitely the same skill set of interviewing multiple witnesses, looking for physical evidence, moving through the community when very few journalists have ever even gone into La Saline. I think today was what your work today as a journalist was of extreme importance, because the community is just being completely marginalized by the international media. But I did feel that there's a continuity in the types of human rights work from then to now.
And we just heard from Seth Donnelly, who is a teacher, high school teacher, in the Bay Area and has been returning to Haiti several times. I'd now like to bring into the discussion Judith Merkinson, better known as Merk, and I think it's okay to call you Merk, right? And she is the president of the National Lawyers Guild in the Bay Area. So, Merk, just to again ask the question about the importance of Haiti. I mean, you're here, you were down with our team in La Saline. I know this was not your first trip to Haiti. So tell us why Haiti is important in the context of the kind of human rights work that you are known for.
Haiti has played one of the most essential roles in the history of the Americas, and the history of the world, but particularly in the history of the Americas and in the history of the U.S. from the very beginning, as the first black republic, the first country to overthrow slavery. Unfortunately, that has dogged them for the last hundreds and hundreds of years. And because it's a black republic and because it overcame slavery, it still is the issue of entrenched racism by the United States and by Latin America, I believe, is still there. And I think for us in the United States, often we ignore Haiti for for many reasons. All we hear about Haiti is that it's the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. It's not the poorest, it's been made poor, and it absolutely denies the spirit and the political sophistication of the Haitian people. And I think, you know, that's something that the your listeners, because of the people who listen to your show, really, really have to understand. Because often Haiti gets ignored. People will say, for instance, they'll say the coup happening now in Venezuela is modeled on Honduras. But actually, Honduras was modeled on Haiti. And the two overthrows of President Aristide were deliberate American policies. And so here we are, you know, years later after the coup, and 15 years after the coup, and the American government is still orchestrating, and the Haitian government, installed by the American government, is still terrorizing the people. And now, as the people have been, there's been an incredible uprising in the last 6 to 8 months, the level of terror is something that I think people have to understand. I mean, when we went into La Saline, and the level of terror is, I think, multifaceted and multi-leveled, because on the one hand, there's a level of terror in terms of massacres, the burning of bodies, the dismembering of bodies, leaving bodies to be eaten by pigs. That's extreme. But the other level of terror is how La Saline was before the actual massacre. And if you look at the conditions of the people, even that, I would say, is a human rights disaster. And what everyone has said to us as we've been here just for a few days is that Haiti is facing a human rights disaster, that the situation has deteriorated to the point where people don't know how they're going to live. So I think it behooves us, who are human rights activists and who are social justice activists, who are anti-racists, to actually put Haiti on the map of our work in a way that hasn't happened yet.
Seth Donnelly, I mean, in a way it almost is blows your mind a bit when we look at yesterday, the graduation, as such an important piece of work that's happening at the University of the Aristide Foundation. And if you could share your thoughts on that, and then we're contrasting that with our experience in La Saline today. And we know there's an interrelationship between the two, because part of why the university, UNIFA, is there is exactly to, in a way, address some of what we saw in La Saline today. Seth Donnelly.
Yesterday, as Reyes said, yesterday for me also was extremely special. I'd never been to a UNIFA graduation before, and to see 153 new doctors, 34 nurses, and lawyers as well, to graduate. And for your listeners, I would like them to understand that UNIFA is built by the Popular Movement for Liberation in Haiti. It's an incredible school to serve children and young adults who normally wouldn't be able to afford going to private universities, and even wouldn't be able to necessarily make it to the public universities because there's fees there as well. That UNIFA provides opportunities, and it's itself is a manifestation of the struggle of the Haitian people for liberation and self-determination. So I think yesterday represented, in a sense, what that struggle can achieve, the types of institutions that the Lavalas movement and that the people's struggle can build, and it shows a way forward. And that's what we who are anti-imperialist and who support universal human rights in the United States, we need folks, as Merck said, to put Haiti on the front of their analysis, because it's on the front lines of the struggle against U.S. imperialism, and therefore to stand in active solidarity with these institutions like UNIFA and with this amazing, vibrant, popular movement led by Lavalas. So that's yesterday. Today represents the destructive impact of imperialism. That today is is an extension of the violence of the coup. So in 2005, when we were in Cité Soleil, it was UN forces that were egged on by the U.S. Embassy to assault Cité Soleil, which is one of the poorest neighborhoods in Port-au-Prince, and which was at the time and still is a base of Lavalas resistance calling for the restoration of real democracy in this country. And so they were subjected to a massive massacre. And then same in this year, La Saline is a very poor neighborhood. It's a base of resistance, a center of resistance, a stronghold of Lavalas organizing, and it's been subjected to unrelenting attacks. In this case, by death squad elements backed by the Haitian government, which is in turn, of course, installed and backed up by the U.S. government. So these death squad attacks have massacred people, have subjected people to the types of terror you've heard about already in this program. But we need to say no to that. As Ray is saying, we need to build a mass movement in the United States that can force U.S. government to stop installing and maintaining this neocolonial regime or regimes like this in Haiti. And so to me, what happened yesterday and what happened today are they're two sides of the same coin of what's called upon, of what we're called upon to do as solidarity activists.
When I was at the graduation, one thing that you felt, as you do at many graduations, but in some ways this was deeper, was this feeling of deep joy. You know, you were so happy for the accomplishments of UNIFA and to see these young people who are doctors, lawyers, nurses, physiotherapists, and who are obviously not from the elite, becoming professionals and being able, in the speeches that they made, as in all graduations, they all talked about serving the people and being together and continuing their solidarity as a family from UNIFA. And it was very, very powerful, and it was very beautiful. But as I said, you had a feeling of deep joy. And, you know, as we're sitting here, I can feel myself getting angrier and angrier and angrier and more upset, which I feel like when we just left La Saline, I was just like, yes, that was terrible, but sort of shut down and armored because you couldn't feel because you were so upset. And as we're talking about it, I too feel incredible rage, you know. And, you know, on the one hand, UNIFA is supposed to be a corrective to La Saline, but La Saline is also supposed to be a corrective to UNIFA. It's not just one direction. The reason that they're doing La Saline is to prevent a mass movement, is to prevent UNIFA. And so we have to do both. We have to support on both sides and understand, I think, the interrelationship. And you know, like Rhea and Margaret, as a mother and as a grandmother, it was infuriating, absolutely infuriating, to see these young mothers so skinny. You know, a young pregnant woman who was skin and bones, and yet her ankles were completely swollen, which is a sign of preeclampsia, which is very dangerous. And we asked her, do you have help? She's never been to a doctor. When we went to, the people from La Saline had to be evacuated into this market where they're basically sleeping on the floor on a piece of cardboard. And there's a young mother there with a baby that Rhea talked about who was deathly ill. The mother couldn't feed the baby, and she delivered without a doctor on the concrete floor. This is completely unacceptable. You know, we cannot accept that. And so, it's very hard to talk about it. I think we're all really, really upset, but the upset in a lot of ways has to turn into something else because we're often upset. You know, we're living in a really horrible time, in a really horrible world, but we have to, I think, you know, Rhea said this just makes me want to fight harder. This just makes me more determined, and it makes me feel that way, and it also makes me want to understand even more, like, what's going on and really strategize about how to build a real solidarity movement. And as I I would just say also as women, the women in La Saline talked about how they're the bedrock, which women are all over the world. And in particular, you know, we have to take care of the women, because we saw these students yesterday graduating. And then we saw these children who aren't going to be allowed to graduate because they won't grow up. So we have to grow these children, our future, to grow up, to graduate, and to become the future. And that's on us. That's one of our responsibilities.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to take a short station break. When we return, you'll be hearing from Ron Baca. We'll be honoring Poetry Month. This is National Poetry Month. And Ron Baca, talented poet, based in El Sereno, East Los Angeles, grew up in Boyle Heights. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Discredited and abandoned, everywhere is war. It's a war that until they're no longer first class and second class citizens of any nation.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and of course that music, the late great Bob Marley's War. If you are on Facebook, you can look for us and like us on Facebook. We're also on SoundCloud. Look for us there. Look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott on Twitter and Instagram. You can find our handle at So True Radio. And today, in our tradition, we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in East Los Angeles and internationally. We would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the island nation, the world's first Black Republic of Haiti. We now turn our attention to our interview, a discussion really, with teacher, community worker, and East Los Angeles-based Chicano poet, the talented Ron Baca. So Ron, you're going to do some reading, which I'm really excited about. But first, just share with our listeners a little about yourself. You grew up in East Los Angeles, did you?
I grew up in Boyle Heights. I was born at the White Memorial Hospital, which is on Soto Street and Fort Street, which is no longer a hospital building. Went to local schools, mm-hmm. went to East LA College.
You went to public schools? Or
I went to Catholic schools. Uh-huh. Right, all the way through high school. Mm-hmm. And graduated from Cathedral High School, went to East LA College,
okay.
got kicked out, got back in, graduated from Cal State Los Angeles, where I worked for 15 years before I went into teaching with LA Unified School District.
Oh, LAUSD. All right. Right.
Yeah. I'm a proud teacher.
A proud
and supporter
teacher.
Of the most recent strike.
Yes. Yeah, we were all red for Ed. But Ron, tell us, because on Sojourner Truth, you know, we're a public affairs show. We do a lot of political stuff, local, national, international. And we also do what we call the interrelationship of art and politics. Now, in that time that you were a young person growing up in East L.A., what movements were going on the ground or that you knew about, and were you involved in any of them, or how did you experience what was happening?
Well, I would say that going to Catholic schools, we were kind of sheltered. When I was in high school, they were building Dodger Stadium, and we were totally unaware of the displacement and the gentrification that was taking place up there. We were all like excited that the Dodgers were coming to Los Angeles.
Those in Brooklyn were not the Brooklyn bums, right?
too bad, yeah. You know, uh-huh. But that was the focus, you know, and it wasn't until later when I started to attend, Cal State LA, I took Chicano studies classes, and it was really an eye-opening experience for me to be exposed to political issues that were taking place at the time. I became a supporter of the United Farm Workers and the picket lines and
wow.
MECHA and statewide MECHA. And
tell us what MECHA stands for.
Movimiento Estudiantil Chicano de Aztlán.
Okay.
And became active in left movements, anti-Baki decision work, supportive redress and reparations, and started to read Chicano literature for the very first time. That's when I was exposed to it. And I was very fortunate at Cal State LA because there was a circle of people that I knew and worked with, people like Rocky Rodriguez and Lester Martin, Gerald Bayete, Renee Armelin, Frank Beruman, and David Trujillo, who were also writers, and we would share our work and read to each other. And that's how I became interested in formally writing. My early background was influenced by my mother writing to her father in Albuquerque, New Mexico. My parents are from Albuquerque, and I was amazed that you could write a letter and get a letter back. And I said, wow, that's pretty cool. So as I got older, I started writing to friends who were in the military, in Vietnam, Germany, South Korea, all over the United States. So I began as a letter writer, writing letters. And I like to do that. I like to put things down on paper. Yeah.
So early on, you discovered that power of words and that way of communicating.
Yeah.
And at what point did that morph into your writing poetry? Or was it always there? Were those letters likely poems in and of themselves?
Well, formally.
Informally. Let's start with informally.
Well, I had written, you know, on pieces of paper and put them away and put them in a drawer in a box. And
how old were you when you started to do this?
I was 18, 19 years old.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the major influence in my political writing was Mary Baraka. I went to hear him read at Esalen Bookstore, and the person ahead of me said to him that she wrote poetry. And he says, well, where's your book? And that stunned me. So I didn't mention that I wrote poetry. I just said, I enjoy your poetry, Amari, and you're a real inspiration to me. And he remains an inspiration to me today. You know, his politics, his revolutionary point of view, his position on the Afro-American national question, on the Chicano national question. And so his political writing kind of helped me formalize what I wanted to say as a poet, as a progressive-minded poet.
Yeah, and people also often think of Amiri Baraka as a political person, which he was, right, an involvement in politics, and forget that he's a poet, right? And I happened upon a DVD that I actually got from a mutual acquaintance of ours, Roberto out from Eastside Cafe,
right,
in El Sereno, and of an event with Amiri Baraka. I don't know if you ever saw that, but it was just amazing. And in fact, we have promoted it a few times here on KPFK. So thank you, Beto.
Roberto Flores over at
For all of
Cafe.
That.
Yeah, that was the black and brown unity.
Black and brown unity, right? That's exactly
Amiri
right.
Amiri Baraka and Alorista.
Yeah.
I was at that event. It was at...
Oh, were you?
Yes,
wow.
Los Angeles
That's
City
amazing.
College.
What was that like?
Oh, well,
I would have liked to be a fly on the wall for that event.
Alorista read first. Patricia Recinos was the host of the program, and she did a fantastic job. Uh-huh. She introduced Alorista, and I had never heard him read live. You know, I'd read some of his work, his books and stuff, and he was amazing, just amazing, colorful, picturesque language, and bilingual and trilingual. And difficult to follow, you know, but amazing poet. And then I thought to myself, how's Amiri going to follow this up, you know? And Amiri being Amiri, I just, you know, amazing poet, you know, politically minded and a unifying voice, you know, in the progressive left movement.
Yeah, and indeed, that event on Black-Brown Unity, that actually inspired an event we hosted here in Sojourner Truth on Black Brown Unity that was held at Holman United Methodist Church a few years back. And it definitely, because it's, I mean, it was critical then and so critical now, the whole issue of the whipping up of divisions between Black and Brown communities and the importance really of coming together and also of that history of knowing that so many of those enslaved fled to Mexico, to Mexico. Yes. Where slavery was about, and indeed the war, where the United States basically took land from Mexico. I mean, slavery and was such a critical part of that. And a lot of Black folks here really don't know that history and have to appreciate that history and that kind of historic collaboration. You know what I mean?
That's so true. At this event SO1 books that where Mary was reading, a lot of really young people, college-age students, but there were some movement veterans that were there from the African-American community, and there was one question posed and almost answered at the same time, you know, immigrants are taking our jobs, and they're moving into our neighborhood, and they're demanding bilingual education, and so on, and they're living two families in an apartment and taking over. And Mary's response was just short. He said, to the degree that you blame immigrants, you show your ignorance. And it stayed with me.
Right.
You know.
And a lack of understanding of our own history, the great migration from the South to the North, where whole families, I don't know how many, living in the same apartment, and me from the Caribbean, a lot of my listeners, I'm from Barbados, and, you know, migrating here to the United States and, you know, meeting some of that same kind of pushback. So it's really not even understanding Black history to be able to make statements like that.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, right. So what I want to continue to just chat a bit more with you, but I know that you also want to read some poetry because you're a poet. So why don't we do that and then we could continue talking a little. Is that okay? You ready
to
do a poem?
I'm ready.
Share a poem with our listeners.
Yes, I am.
This is exciting. Okay. Go for it.
This is called The Queen of Salsa. This is for Sophia. The Queen of Salsa came to me in a dream last night, and Selena and Joe Henderson and Tito Puente too. Talking and laughing, we toasted one another far into the morning of a new day, like children discovering the other side of midnight for the first time. We talked about music, and how young people are reaching back to the 60s and 70s golden era of music and making it a part of their musical world. Mostly we talked about peace among our families and friends, peace among people of color and all peoples of the world, peace in our children's lives, peace in our music, and the activism necessary to attain it. We sang and danced salsa, cumbias, boleros, cha-cha-chas, and merengues, making up our steps as we went along. And it didn't matter when someone sang out of tune. While Joe and Tito combined their musical magic, I composed this poem for Celia, and Selena performed it for her. We gave Celia a standing ovation because we love her, and she loves us too. Celia Cruz, the Queen of Salsa, appeared in my dream last night. Her music will live forever.
Wow. Love it. That's fantastic. Romero, we're going to have to get some Celia Cruz music and integrate it in there. So I can see what inspired that particular poem.
Yeah.
But also I suppose when one hears poetry, you know, people feel different things. I mean, you could really just the use of the words and how they are put together evoke emotion, evoke an image, you know what I mean? Evoke creates thoughts, evokes feelings, and all of that is present in that poem. So, but also present was what we call the interrelationship between art and politics.
That's right. That's right. You got it.
Yeah.
You know,
it's all in there.
Yeah. You start with a perspective, you know, on your life, your family, your neighborhood, your community, what's going on. And your writing reflects that perspective, you know, that you have an opinion about what's going on. It's great to write about whatever, but I think, you know, having a perspective on life is very, very important and central to poetry. You know, your imagery, your language, your way of, you know, presenting it to your audience is very, very key. That comes from your point of view.
Yeah, and also, I mean, did you find, and one may have nothing to do with each other, but in terms of the music that you're drawn to or the kind of music that you're drawn to, do you think not only your, because being a poet is part of who you are. I mean, you are a holistic person. I know people like to kind of divide people up. You're Chicano over here. You're a poet here. You're a dad over there. You know, you're a son over here. But it's all one person, one entity. And in terms of music, and I mean, did you find that you were drawn to a particular kind of music or other parts of the arts? Perhaps having an appreciation of it, that if you don't have the craft or the gift of poetry that you do, that others of us might have to struggle a bit more to appreciate.
Well, I'm waiting for your poem, Margaret, because you just let out a poem right there. Yes. Well, you know, music is it's kind of like a universal language, you know. And,
yeah.
I would say music has influenced my writing quite a bit. When I'm writing, I'm listening to the Supremes, listening to Otis Redding.
All right.
I got to hear Aretha, you know. Uh-huh. I got to hear Quetzal.
Yeah.
Las Cafeteras. Mm-hmm. Celia Cruz. There's a certain rhythm to their music that inspires me. Their message, you know, their performances. I've seen Quetzal perform live and full of energy, you know. And so, that's been a great inspiration. Artists, musicians, painters, young poets, you know. There are murals in City Terrace in the alleyway. There's a famous mural by a fantastic artist, Willie Heron. There's an image of this figure busting through the wall, and her fist is out, and her mouth is coming out of the wall.
Wow.
And and we have to create space for that, for ourselves, you know. We can't take a back seat. We can't wait, you know. We got to be out there. We got to be part of what's going on. And in some instances, take the leadership role.
Why we can't wait. And I don't know about me and poetry. I very much appreciate it. My daughter, actually, who was born in East L.A. and who grew up in El Sereno, and you actually heard her recently in her talk at Occidental. Thank you for coming out for that. And also, I have to remind our audience, this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and our guest. I'm sitting here in studio with the Ron Baca, who is a Chicano poet and writing for a number of years, grew up in Boyle Heights in East Los Angeles, and now still in East Los Angeles, but in El Sereno community. And this is, well, it's April. It's National Poetry Month. And so we're doing our bit here. And I've been trying to get Ron to come in for some time and read poetry. So I was really thrilled. I said, aha, it's National Poetry Month. He's got to turn up now. Right? But I just to say,
I'm happy to be here, Margaret. Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, well, I'm delighted that you are. And I think the last a poem that I wrote. I'm not really a poet, but it really just came out of grief. I think that was the time that Michael Zinzin died. Michael Zinzin was an activist here in Southern California and the head of the Coalition Against Police Abuse, and was really quite a figure, taking on LAPD and much more. But in the work that I was doing and continue to do around the serial murders of Black women in South Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And Michael was doing security for me because, you know, there were all kinds of threats from the police, et cetera, and going out with us to the Strip at night when we were giving out information to the women. And it was just such a loss that actually I was supposed to say something at the funeral, and all I could muster was a poem. And that's unusual for me, because usually I'm writing press releases or flyers, you know, that kind of thing. So I know what you mean about, you know, when something really has to come out.
Right.
And it really takes that form, good or bad. You know,
yes.
it takes that
yes,
form.
You're right.
So, Ron, I'm wondering, do you have any more? Can we have another one? Another poem, please?
This is called Black Cat, White Cat. This is for Camilo. A black cat runs into the street, gets run over several times, squashed, flattened, unsightly. Several days later, it's shoveled to the curb, and it lays there out of reach on the street sweeper's round. Several weeks later, the street sweeper somehow manages to maneuver and sweeps it up. A white cat runs into the street, setting off a multi-car pileup collision. Several motorists continue to receive treatment at the scene for minor bumps and bruises. However, two people were airlifted to a nearby trauma center in critical but stable condition. The cat escaped injury and has been reunited with its thankful, grateful, happy owner, as reported live on the 6 o'clock evening news.
Wow, what a contrast with your first poem. Tell us, what inspired this particular poem? Or was there an inspiration for it? I don't quite know how these things work. Were you listening to something or saw something and decided, hey, I'm going to do this?
Well, several images appeared. My son Camilo told me about this this dog that had been run over on the railroad tracks. You know where the railroad tracks
are?
Yeah, in El Sereno. Right?
Yep.
And you got to be careful whether you're a human or an animal crossing those tracks. But
yeah.
I kind of took it as, you know, what happens to people of color, how they're valued, you know, how we're valued, how we're not valued, what's important, what makes the news, you know, and what doesn't, the things that go on. You mentioned the murders of Black women in South Central, you know, where was that? Who was talking about it? So that's kind of like how it transitioned from something that was real to another example of the work we need to do.
The devaluation, the ongoing devaluation of so many of us. And I'll have to say for young people, I'm glad we do have a number of young listeners, and some of whom may be budding poets, and some may be doing poetry in a form of music, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of the rappers, some of the best of them, you find a dose of reality and also poetry in them. And are you now doing any work with young people?
I'm a volunteer at volunteer tutor at Homeboy Industries, and
tell our listeners about Homeboy Industries. They may not know what it is.
Well, Homeboy was begun by Father Greg Boyle, and started in East LA working with street gangs and youth who were influenced by negative things. And I'll just put it that way, because yeah. sometimes it happens in the classroom and happens at home, it happens in the street.
Yeah.
And so Homeboy Industries was began. And one of the t-shirts that I think says a lot is, "Nothing stops a bullet like a job." And so the new Homeboy is maybe 10 years old, and it's on Alameda and Bruno. And I go there twice a week to tutor. And these are young people that come back at 30, sometimes 40 years old, and they want their high school diploma, and they want their GED, and they want a yeah. job, and they want to go to receive the kinds of services that should have been available to them when they were young.
Mm-hmm.
And some have been in and out and in and out again. And Homeboy is a place where they get the services that they need and the support they need to become the person that they deserve.
And in that setting, to use that corny phrase about, did you find any poets who didn't know it, right? I mean, just in the tutoring that you've been doing and working with some of them, did you see that there were some possibilities there?
Well, one of the things that I've noticed is the storytelling.
Ah.
I mean, some wonderful stories that they will tell you in a hot moment. They'll run their life wow. to you in a moment. They'll tell you what went on in their life, you know. I haven't yeah. seen too much like mm-hmm. written down, you know,
right.
where, I mean, that's not, it's not a workshop that I do there. It's tutoring and, mm-hmm. and math and English and reading and
but that storytelling subjects. Is important.
The
that's modern day griot.
And wow. I'm amazed at the stories. So the next couple of poems I'd like to read are based on stories that and experiences that I've had there.
Okay, so maybe we'll do that next. And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and guest poet Ron Baca, based in El Sereno in East Los Angeles. And Ron is going to share another poem with us. And, of course, this is National Poetry Month. And a lot of people don't know that. Established back in 1996, apparently. Mm. And I'll bet you there was a push, you know, because when things get established, it usually is a whole grassroots kind of effort that leads to something like that. So right. I suspect that was the case.
Right.
Ron Baca.
This is a poem. I gave this to Emily. She works at Homeboy Industries. The poem is called "Car Wash for Roxy at SoCal Burgers." Cars come away clean and shiny. Pain refuses to be washed away so easily. 5, 6, 7-year-old girls in shorts and t-shirts, ponytails tied with colorful hair clips, bows and ribbons, wipe down fenders, doors, bumpers, and grills. Young men, teenagers, moms pushing strollers, a community of homies healing itself, mending their lives together, one car wash at a time. Overhead, an airplane ferries passengers to their destination. A homeboy notices a homegirl in tears, standing off by herself on the sidewalk. He walks up to her and hugs her. He speaks to her in a soft tone of voice, not to ease her pain, but to share in it.
Well, just speaks for itself, Ron, I think. A community healing itself. Young people finding their way.
You know, these are people yeah. that couldn't walk the same sidewalk at one time, showing love for each other, compassion, support, healing together. it's amazing. You know, it's very amazing.
I remember that. I remember my my daughter, and she was born in East L.A. Actually, I never made it to the hospital. So, you know that song, Born in East L.A.? She really was born in El Sereno,
my
in East L.A.
Too, she was born in City Terrace at home.
Right across the freeway from El Sereno, from where I was and where I am, still am. But I remember in terms of her, she, you know, is a public school kid, and knowing that she's not going to wear red. She's just not going to wear red, right? And having to kind of, she was bused to a public school on the, was kind of on the west side, was the name of that school, Laces. She'll kill me, I don't remember what Laces stands for now, but it was down near Fairfax somewhere. And, you know, she had to be up early in the morning and get across those railroad tracks. Mm-hmm. To get to the school bus on time, right? And if that train came along, forget it. You know, you're just sitting there like, oh my God, I'm going to miss a school bus. But just kind of having to explain to those kids, well, no, I'm not wearing red, and why? And also, there was a period of time where there was a lot more activity, and we would sometimes you would hear shot, you know, sounds that you knew were gunshots, and she knew to like, get down on the floor. You know, just the kinds of things that one, you don't think of, you know, perhaps living in another part of town. Another story was my mom was visiting sometime and the staying in the front room, and we woke up the next morning. Luckily, she slept through it, and there was a bullet, maybe it was a pellet, but it didn't quite break through the glass. But I was thinking, oh my God, maybe a pellet gun, but somebody, you know. So when in your poem, and you talked about the planes flying over, and you think of the people who just drive down the 10 freeway or any of those freeways in the inner cities, and you don't see the people who are there. That's and right. Have no understanding of what their lives mm-hmm. are like or mm-hmm. what they have to go through mm-hmm. living in certain neighborhoods.
Right. That's right.
Yeah.
So true.
I think that your poem reflected some of that. Ron Baca, based in El Sereno in East Los Angeles, we really appreciate you coming and spending this time with us and inspiring me and I'm sure our whole team and our listeners. We appreciate you and we hope you join us again.
I appreciate the invitation. I'll be more than glad to. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ron Baca. We're out of time. Today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the entire Sojourner Truth team, assistant producer Romero Funes, and we want to give Romero a special thanks for his incredible work while we were on the ground in Haiti. We also want to thank our engineer, Mr. T. Teddy Robinson, and we'd like to thank the Real News Network for their support for us and our efforts on the ground in Haiti. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. And remember to visit our website, sotrueradio.org, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at SoTrueRadio. Thank you so much for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.